do have action that will need to be taken that requires a quorum be present. So before we begin our action, let me just express appreciation for today's forecast. It was a very good day in Minnesota. We learned that our budget deficit went from a projected $1.1 billion to $673, I believe, million. Anyways, certainly much positive news in the right direction, and as we understand it, that this was really a result of better business results than previously anticipated. So given we're higher ed and workforce development, we celebrate that success. So with that, I will take up the confirmation of the governor's appointees to the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority. Previously, we have confirmed some of them, but we have Catherine Ballstead Brewer, Gary Benson, Raymond Vinzant, and Janet Whithoff with us today. So if all of you would come to the table. In our last meeting, when we addressed this, the other confirmations, we had a chance to get the overview of the Higher Ed Facilities Authority, and really we're left with how important that you are to us and what a great service you provide in terms of your financial help. So with that, what I'd like to do today is just if you could briefly share a little bit about yourself and your intentions with regard to this nomination. So we'll start with Catherine Ballstead Brewer.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Could you state your name for the record?
Yes, my name is Catherine Ballstead Brewer, and I'm probably the senior member of the authority. Certainly in terms of age, I don't think anyone here will deny that.
We won't ask.
But also in terms of tenure, I was appointed by Governor Arne Carlson in 1990, and each governor after that. So I've served over 20 years on the commission.
Well, thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you. I think that my background lends itself to the authority. I spent many years at U.S. Bank Corp. As a senior vice president, and I worked in a number of areas that were important to the authority, for example, in real estate construction finance, and I managed the public finance department as I moved through the organization. I left U.S. Bank Corp. in 1990, and I went back and received my Ph.D. in strategic management and organization, and I did consulting work for a number of higher ed organizations, including St. Thomas, and I taught business ethics at the MBA level. I retired in 2001, and I guess I should say just a few words about why I think the authority is so important. I think the work is critically important to the higher education facilities throughout the organization or throughout the state. I think the very nature of the colleges depend on how they present themselves to their constituencies, whether they're students or funders. And I also think that the way that they create an environment of learning is very important, and I think so much of the time they do that through the building environment. So I'd like to continue working with both the colleges and with the authority, and I hope that you see fit to confirm my appointment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have Gary Benson.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Benson. I got appointed to the authority in 1999, have had the privilege of serving on the authority ever since, and am eager to be reappointed again if that would happen, and look forward to more service to the state of Minnesota in that regard. A little bit about my background. Since graduating from college in the 1970s, I've spent 38 years working in the construction industry in a number of different areas, from working with contractors, construction managers, and I even spent 7 years in the 80s with an architectural firm in Minneapolis. And so I've got kind of a vast background that I think brings some construction expertise to the type of proposals that we see at the authority from the colleges and the higher ed institutions that present their plans for bonding assistance. And in particular, the last 20 years for myself, I've been involved primarily in the education, project planning, project development, project funding side of things, both higher education and K-12 education. I feel that my expertise brings a look at these proposals in terms of evaluating their feasibility and their sustainability as we consider requests for fund for bond funding. And I guess I would just say that I would be enthusiastic about being able to continue on the authority, and I hope that meets with favor with this committee and the Senate as well. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for your long time service. Next, we have Raymond VanZant.
Thank you. I was appointed under Governor...
Could you just say your name for the record?
My name is Raymond VanZant, and I was appointed under Governor Pawlenty and reappointed under Governor Dayton recently. I began in the construction trades in 1968 and have worked consecutively in the construction trades since then, all the way up through the ranks to owning my own business. And then in about 2001, I created an apprenticeship training program and began teaching it at the college level, and I taught it for 10 years until I retired. And then I've maintained my construction business throughout. I have quite an extensive background in construction, so I think I lend well to the authority, and I would love to continue.
Well, thank you very much for your service. And finally, Janet Whithoff.
Hello. My name is Janet Whithoff, and I was appointed to the authority the first time in 2007, and I've now been reappointed to a second term. My interest in serving on this board comes from my background of almost 19 years dealing with tax-exempt debt, first on the issuer side for 9 years, and then as a trustee for almost 10 years. I enjoy very much hearing about the various deals, but I think because of my background, I can lend a perspective in knowing the entire process that is probably maybe unique, except for Catherine, on the board. I very much enjoy serving. I personally have my own business. I write grants and do project management and planning with nonprofits, human service nonprofits. And so I hope that I would be confirmed and can continue my service on the board.
Well, thank you very much. It's clear that given you have all lasted through governors of different political persuasions, it's a nonpartisan position that you hold, and that tradition has been honored. So are there any questions from members? With that, I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I Senator move that Klassen? Catherine Ballstead Brewer, Gary Benson, Raymond VanZant, Janet Whithoff be accepted as appointees to the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority.
So moved. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Congratulations. You have now been confirmed or recommended for confirmation. It'll go to the Senate floor. We wish we had that power to confirm. And I just wanted you to know that there's later in the agenda, Senator Klassen has a bill up that has to do with debt that I don't know if you plan to stay for the whole committee, but you might enjoy hearing that conversation. Thank you. Well, members, in just a few moments, I'm going to be asking Soren Laggard to do a presentation for us, and I wanted you to have an understanding of just where this is coming from. So as we began this session talking about the issues that were of most concern to us, we identified the area of student debt, we identified the importance of graduation rates, and all of that in an overall context of just how important it is for our young people to be appropriately trained in a post-secondary field that is relevant to their ability to have a thriving and full career. And as we identify these objectives, then, of course, you peel the apple and you find out, you know, where are we succeeding and where are we failing? And to that point, which institutions are doing better on in that report card, and in what areas which aren't, where are our successes and where are our opportunities? And so as we began to have that conversation, some areas of concern came forward. And Soren, I'll ask you to come to the chair. We are fortunate enough in our office to not just have a wonderful committee administrator and legislative assistant, but we have several interns. One of them is actually a law student at William Mitchell College of Law, and this is Soren Laggard. Soren was a native of Cambridge, Minnesota. He's a first-year law student at William Mitchell. He attended Boston College for his undergrad, and he's passionate about educational issues. He actually called me in December to ask if he could help on ed reform. He is a he was a teacher with Teach for America in Louisiana for 3 years. So we asked Soren to do some research, and we're so impressed with what he brought forward that I asked him to present this research to the committee. And I want people to understand this is a conversation starter. I'm hoping that people do ask questions. Feel free to stop during it, and then we'll talk about following the report where we might want to go as a committee from here. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Lagarde.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. It's my privilege to address this committee on a topic as a law student near and dear to me, student debt.
And, so say your name for the record.
And my name is Soren Lagarde. And more specifically, I want to talk today about the state grant program. So this presentation, as Senator Bonhoeff said, is meant to be a conversation starter. We go over a lot of data in this presentation, but not every data point, just covering major themes right now as we're finding them. So to talk a little bit about our agenda, first I'll talk a little bit about pressing issues in higher education, our federal developments, California's approach, possible Minnesota approaches, and some conclusions in question time. But feel free to ask questions at any point during this presentation. So, the problem in Minnesota, cost to students. Rising tuition costs have increasingly forced students to rely on federal and state funding sources. In 2011, the average debt for a four-year program was $29,793. And that's a lot. That places us in the third out of 48 states that we have data for in average student debt. The bar graph at the right also shows average tuition and fees, which you can see are considerably higher than the national average. So we have a high cost of attending college, so not surprisingly, we have a high level of student debt. The second part of that problem is graduation rates. By 2018, 70% of jobs in Minnesota will require some form of post-secondary education. That means 620,000 job vacancies by 2018. It's a lot of jobs to fill and jobs that will require some form of post-secondary education. And then for the class of 2005 or students entering college in 2005, 62% of them in Minnesota, 62% of Minnesotans entering college in 2005 graduated within 6 years. So we have a gap is the bottom line. We need more Minnesotans attending college, and we need more Minnesotans to graduate. So how do we get there? So the two big questions, how do we reduce student debt, and how do we increase college graduation rates so we can, you know, be a competitive state in 2018 when we will have that need? So one way is the state grant program. The state grant program is a proven tool to encourage students to attend and complete college on time. We have higher, while compared to our peers, we have higher college access rates relative to neighboring states for lower income students and students of color. We've seen that's an effective behavioral tool, but what if it was expanded to include behavior in the marketplace? So looking at the marketplace and institutions that grant degrees for Minnesotans, what if we looked at how the money we were giving them was, looked at? So the federal government is asking the same question and looking at this issue. So last year, the U.S. Senate Help Committee released a report on for-profit colleges. That report, after a two-year investigation, found a pattern of inferior education, a high dropout rates, high debt rates, and some loan manipulation. And roughly 80% of all for-profit funding comes from state and federal taxpayer money. So the graph you can see on the right chronicles for the United States a difference between public university graduation rates and for-profit university graduation rates, along with their average tuition for two-year and four-year programs. And you can see that for-profit graduations are almost more than half reduced, as well as two- and four-year tuition is much more expensive. The next slide focuses in on Minnesota. And this is the per-student spending in 2010 for three Minnesota-based institutions that are for-profit universities. So Capella, Rasmussen, and Walden. And it covers three categories: the instruction, or cost of actually teaching a student, associated with paying the teacher, classroom facilities, other additional things. Then the profit associated for the for-profit institutions, and then the advertising, or the amount that they spend recruiting students. Looking at the data, you can see that for instruction, the U of M spends about $13,000, whereas Capella spends about $1,600, Walden very similarly, and Rasmussen about $4,800. These figures include, should be noted, that the University of Minnesota has multiple missions, such as research and other services, so that figure is probably a little higher relative to other institutions. And that Capella and Walden are 100% online universities. And so their figure is a little less because they don't have classrooms. But still, the data shows that there is a big gap between what is being spent on instruction and what is being spent on profit and advertising.
So, Mr. Lagarde, in terms of the, it's showing the profit, and are the, so in terms of these numbers, tell us a little bit about, are they're not public companies, but yet they were able to get the profit numbers?
That is correct. So the HELP committee requested information from these institutions, and they voluntarily provided it. But it is normally a little, because they're not public institutions, they're under no obligation to release this data. So the Harkin report was the first instance of us having that information.
So they're saying that Capella spent per student $4,538 on advertising, Rasmussen six whatever, and two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you. That number for the University of Minnesota, $13,200
Yes.
Is there tuition?
That is, some of that money is accumulated from tuition. That's what they're actually spending, though, on the student in the class.
And instruction. So the measure, Senator Sheeran, is the question that was asked is, you know, this is how much tuition is at all these institutions. How much of that tuition goes towards instruction versus advertising, whatever?
That's what I'm trying to. So you're saying that the tuition at Rasmussen is $4,800?
No, the amount they spend on instruction. We had a previous slide, if you want to go back, showed the do you have the tuition?
Yes, that actually is coming up in a little bit.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out is
that you want the percentage of advertising dollars spent versus tuition.
No, they're saying that
we'll get to it.
I'm wondering how you're calculating the $13,000 at the university is for student instruction. How do you know that that's where that's spent? How is it broken out from some information that you've gotten that you know that that is, that those are equivalent comparisons between the U of M, Rasmussen, Walden, and Capella? How do you know that we're talking apples, apples, apples?
Sure. So I think there is a degree of apples to apples there. The Harkin report compared them directly. And I think the Harkin report got this information using, iPads and other standardized data sources. So it does show kind of that gap. And I think, to your point, the University of Minnesota is a multiple mission institution. So that money and that figure that they're spending also goes towards programs that are perhaps not at flagship institutions, such as, research, additional research money that they will focus on. And then I think the last thing, just to continue to note, is the total amount of federal funds being spent at these institutions. So Capella derives 80% of its revenue from federal sources, and that's primarily federal loans. And Rasmussen and Walden are very similar. For-profit universities do have a rule. It's called the 90-10 rule, which is they can't derive more than 90% of their funds from a federal or state public source. And so many universities like these here will often be in the 80s or, you know, high 80s, actually, to prevent, you know, the 90% figure from triggering. So that's their upper echelon. So that was the Harkin report. Continuing on, many states saw this report come out last year and are thinking about how to deal with this problem. And so one approach was California's. California has the same concerns we do and many of the same programs. Too many students are paying too much for too little. They have a program just like our state grant program called CalGrants. And CalGrant spending is also growing as particularly in California, their tuition is also increasing rapidly. And so CalGrant spending doubled from 2006 to 2011. The quick facts chart on the right talks a little bit about, you know, just a comparison of the two programs. I think a kind of interesting statistic to look at is that while California spent $94 million in aid for giving students money to go to for-profit universities in California, Minnesota spent only $15 million. However, as a percentage of our total program, it was 6% in California before they instituted a program I'm about to talk about. And right now in Minnesota, last year, it was 11% for us, so almost double. So California, looking at this and seeing that for-profit institutions were getting a lot of money and instituted some basic performance requirements for getting a state grant in California. So the first performance requirement was, if you want to get be eligible to receive state grant money, you need to have a minimum 30% graduation rate for that institution. The second thing, over the course of 3 years after a student graduates, you need to have at least no more than a 15.5% default rate. That's students who can't afford to pay their loans anymore and are defaulting on them. Not exactly high bars. To make this applicable to specific colleges, they decided to make it only for college, apply only to colleges that derive 40% or more of their students with federal loans. And in California, this de facto exempted community colleges, often because they're more affordable in California, many students that go to community colleges don't actually take out federal loans. Though in the chart that I'll show next, it shows that many California community colleges also have high default rates. They also had just a couple of additional components. They started with a 30% year default rate their first year implementing this program, and then moved it down to a 15.5%. So they phased it in gradually to give colleges time to see that this was coming. They also...
Question. Oh, Senator Sharon.
What is the reasoning behind the college applicability?
I think in California...
Mr. Lugard.
I think in California, their primary concern was to make sure that if we're going to put requirements for state funding, we need to make sure that state and federal funding in, you know, making these colleges eligible, that we need to have these colleges actually have some degree of state and federal funding. And they set it at a rather arbitrary number, 40%.
So, for example, if the taxpayer dollars aren't going into the loan program, then they weren't going to be part of that restriction.
It's the 40%. I'm just trying to figure out how they came to that, and you're saying you're not. That's arbitrary. You're not sure.
It was arbitrary, but it was designed to exempt the California community college system.
Oh, it was designed to do
Senator
that.
Sharon, yep. They yep. didn't want to hurt their community colleges who were serving their most broadest group.
Exactly. So, and community colleges like here in California are open enrollment, essentially. And with that, just they had two additional components. They started with a 30-year default, or I'm sorry, I already spoke about that. And they also added comprehensive reporting requirements. In the Harkin report, there was some concern that for-profit universities were massaging their three-year default rates by encouraging students to go into forbearance or to other mechanisms where they would be avoided and not counted as a statistic against the for-profit institution. And so California, thinking about what is the best way to, you know, get more data about how really are students doing at these institutions, added some more performance requirements. And they're getting that data now and to understand better. And in the future, think about how to evaluate a performance of a college and how that college might be evaluated. And so this graph represents a bunch of little dots, represents all of the colleges in California. The red dots are for-profit institutions. The varying degrees of blue dots are the nonprofit, community colleges, and public universities. The horizontal axis is the percentage of students who default on their loans within 3 years, whereas the vertical axis is the percentage of students who take out a federal loan. And using that criteria that I discussed on the last slide, they kind of boxed in the group of colleges that they deemed were not performing and not doing right by California students. And so you can see primarily that colleges that derived a lot of their funding sources from federal and state sources and that had a high default rate were deemed ineligible to receive Cal Grant state funding in the future. To break down that just a little more, this result, those dots on the last slide, 154 or 35% of Cal Grant colleges failed to meet the standards and were declared ineligible for Cal Grants. Of those 154, 137 or 80% were for-profit colleges. It should be noted that the second requirement, or I guess rather the first requirement, that you need to have a 30% graduation rate only impacted six colleges and made them ineligible. So many more colleges have difficulty with their default rates rather than their graduation, meeting that 30% graduation rate bar. So talking about students and talking about who was impacted. This impacted 14,500 students who wanted to attend these for-profit institutions which were no longer eligible under this new system. And this actually resulted in a taxpayer savings in the initial year estimated at $10.4 million due to these students instead not having their Cal Grants anymore to attend the institution, the for-profit institution that they wanted to, transferred to less expensive public and nonprofit schools, where the California grant was would more than cover the cost of attendance. California, in their law, also built in a reflection component, thinking about, well, let's make sure that we're actually accomplishing and holding institutions accountable in the marketplace for their behavior. And so last month, California issued a report about this new system, and they had several reflections about how, you know, to make it better. One was to consider using other ways to calculate eligibility rather than just looking at graduation rate and just looking at default rate, especially because default rates, given the Harkin report, that there's some concern that they're manipulated in some way. So consider using the repayment rate, which is the number of students or the percentage of students who are actually paying their student loans each month. Another rate is the debt-to-earnings ratio, which after you graduate college and you have a job, your income, how much of your income is actually going to paying down your debt? And both of these data are harder for colleges to manipulate. They also recommended, and to your point, Senator, to remove the 40% federal loan requirement. It's somewhat arbitrary, and actually apply the maximum loan default rate to all colleges. And so going back to that chart, rather than having it a 40% threshold, dropping it down all the way. And so holding that criteria to any university or college that receives Cal Grant funding. They also said, to be absolutely fair, to take into consideration the student population served. For-profits serve a higher percentage of non-traditional and disadvantaged students. And so is there a metric of some kind that we can use to look at and to calculate that into the equation to make sure that we're not funding or prohibiting funding to colleges that do serve, you know, a greater percentage of non-traditional and disadvantaged students? And with that, looking kind of back to our marketplace in Minnesota and looking at our data.
Oh, I'm sorry. Before you do that, could you just mention, you told me about another state?
Oh, absolutely. So there is one other state looking at this problem right now, and it's Maryland. And Maryland's solution is a little more, instead of imposing accountability and metrics, they've decided to phase out funding for their state grant program to for-profit universities entirely. And so by 2015, there will be no funding for state grant, or state grants will not fund any for-profit institution.
Okay, thank you.
You betcha. So going back to Minnesota, looking at our three-year default percentages and in relation to the metric that California used, compared to the U.S. average and our peer states like Wisconsin and Iowa, Minnesota does really well, actually, overall, and especially in the private for-profit area. Looking at the public two-year rate, it's 14.7%, and the private for-profits is 10.1%. Also, private not-for-profit and public 4 years are relatively around 4%, and our total average is right around 9%, so better than most. But it's important to keep, and I think it's important to keep our situation in mind when thinking about any policy we would move forward on. So gainful employment is one of the things that came out of the California legislative report that I mentioned and looking at the debt to earnings ratio and the repayment rate. And it's also a metric that the federal government and the Department of Education are looking at now for implementing for their federal loan program. And it's a brand new thing. There's not a lot of data on it yet, and there's big gaps. But it is a better, what we believe is maybe a better way to assess what is actually the value of an education and how well that institution educated a student. So this is a quick little snapshot of gainful employment in just a medical assistant associate degree in Minnesota, a degree that is currently in high demand in Minnesota with our growing medical services market. And it looks at 3 for-profit colleges that offer this degree relative to 2 Minsky institutions that do. And I'm going to start kind of backwards talking about it here a little bit. So you can see the program costs and for Globiner University is $39,000, Minneapolis Business College, $30,000, Rasmussen, $27,000, and then looking at the Minsky institutions, $8,000 and $11,000, respectively. So a great savings to go to Minsky institution relatively to cost. And to with that, kind of going to the next column over, looking at those Title IV loans, or those which are primarily federal loans that students take out. And you can see that there's a lot more debt associated coming out of college, a degree from a for-profit institution relative to Minsky, including Century College, which doesn't have any federal debt. Also, the debt to earnings ratios, the one that looks at overall income, and then also the more specific one that focuses just on your discretionary income, so accounting for housing and food and other staple items. The lower that number is, the better it is. So Century College and actually Ridgewater do decently. And I think to be noted too that there is we have for Rasmussen is 0 and 0, and I think that may reflect just holes in the data that we have right now since this is a new way of measuring systems. And then the repayment rate is what percentage of students are repaying their loans. So just a quick snapshot of that. Then the question is, so what if we did implement the California model? What would it look like in Minnesota? So the graph here on slide 16 looks at Minnesota institutions using the California metrics. And so a 15.5% default rate and 40% student loans. And so what you have here is the red squares represent private for-profit institutions in Minnesota, and our blue diamonds are community colleges, green triangles are private nonprofits, and the X's is the Minsky Universities and the University of Minnesota. This is also on the sheet that is accompanied by this. That singles out several institutions. It has a key at the bottom of it if the slide is a little hard to read. So this is the Minnesota model, and it doesn't really catch apply to Minnesota schools. It doesn't really catch too many schools, and it actually has the effect of impacting some of our community colleges, where versus California, more students in Minnesota take out a federal loan in order to attend our community colleges. So what if we wanted to change that a little? And this is absolutely an arbitrary designation, but what if we moved it to 10% default rate over 3 years and 60% federal loans? And we see how many cut out because we don't want to cut off access to open enrollment institutions. And so this has the impact of hitting many more private for-profit institutions. And it's just one possible way to look at it. And those institutions, those red squares on there are chronicled on the sheet that came with the presentation. And so looking at that sheet, if you have it, it talks a little bit about absolutely their three-year loan default rate, their graduation rate, the number of students that attend these institutions, which is important if you think about how, you know, having just a few students can make a big percentage difference if, you know, you have 39 students attending and 10 are defaulting on their loans. And then how many students out of that total are state grant students and how many receive state grant funding? And what is that total of that state grant funding? And you can see with the ones that are chronicled here that nearly $12 million, if we were to implement this chart, it would save $12 million from these institutions and would incentivize students to attend a different institution because these are having a high default rate and in some of many cases a rather low graduation rate as well. So in conclusion, this presentation is just meant to be a conversation starter. Again, the big question is, how can we prioritize state funding to reduce debt rates and increase graduation rates for our students? And along with that, how do we ensure taxpayer dollars are going to good investments?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the work. You know, I'm sure there could be some who are listening to this and thinking, well, is this an intention to weed out for profits and is that what we're trying to do here? Or there could be some who are thinking this isn't particularly fair, especially when we see that the story in Minnesota perhaps isn't as bleak as what it looks like nationally. And those would be valid, and I should be noted for the record that anybody was able to come and testify on their behalf in response to this report. And we will be having further conversations. But I think what is worth noting, so this isn't, this conversation isn't meant to single out and say that we have some intention as of today, but rather to say that it's unacceptable to us that our kids aren't graduating and that they have this amount of debt and that we're using state dollars to accomplish those lack of objectives and outcomes. So I'd like, you know, any questions, comments, and to talk about as a committee where we go from here. Senator Klassen.
Chair, thank you. And again, I really appreciate the work you've done on this, and it goes over some areas that we've already covered too, and kind of reaffirms some of the earlier data that we looked at. I think we need to get a response from different universities, colleges, for-profit, non-profit, and get a response. But I think when you look at this, it's very concerning. Are we making wise investments in higher education loans for our students? Are we using our money wisely? So I think this is very valuable information. I think it's an issue we definitely need to address.
Thank you. One of the things I wondered is if we couldn't begin with perhaps the reporting requirement and say that that certainly as a first step that if you get state dollars that, in fact, you're required to report on the measures that we say are critical. So whether that be a repayment rate or, and I believe Mr. Legard has mentioned to some of us that actually a court did not uphold the repayment rate as a measure that they accepted because apparently it's a new measure. But they did uphold the debt-to-earnings ratio. So if we were to identify, first of all, get the data to say that if you are allowed to access state dollars, that with that comes a string, and that string is that you report into the metrics that we have. So thoughts on that? It's just you and me, Senator Claussen. It's not a thorough discussion, but
I think we do need to have an opportunity for profit, nonprofit colleges, universities to respond to this. But once again, I think too, we need to establish what are the metrics. We need to make sure we've got good data so that we can make good decisions. And I think this is a good start. Getting a response from them, but also implementing some metrics that we believe are important, and we have some true measurements, and then I think we can make some solid decisions on where we want to go from here.
Very good. And I think, you know, it is my intention not to have a conclusion to this discussion, but rather to have this be an open door and a beginning. And so I do look forward to having various conversations with the institutions, and perhaps we'll even work in the over the interim on this as a project. So is there anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and testify at this time or make comments? Okay, very good. Well, again, thank you so much for your work and for your report.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon, any comments before we close?
I really appreciated this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. So next on the agenda, we have, I believe, Senator Claussen's bill, Senate File 403. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Greg Claussen. I'm a member of the Minnesota Senate, and I represent the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Coates, and Northeast Lakeville.
And thank you. For the record, you're the vice chair of the committee.
Thank you for adding that, yes. And thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And this is a good segue for what we've just seen here about student debt, because this bill that I'm going to be sharing with you, or rather Senate file, hopefully tries to address that. Senate file 403 is a funding appropriation proposal requesting to analyze the feasibility and appropriate components of a program that would assist Minnesota residents in refinancing student loans for higher education. And again, as we've just seen, students in Minnesota are leaving our colleges, universities with a great deal of debt. Yesterday, I was visited by six students who are all occupational therapist students or graduates. The highest debt level of one that has just received her master's degree in occupational therapy was $60,000. So she's leaving college with $60,000 in debt, but she does have a master's degree. The lowest amount of debt in the group was a junior, and she has $20,000 of debt as a junior. And again, these are people that are working on occupational therapist degrees. So we've had a lot of testimony, and we have met a lot of students that have shared their stories with us. What Senate File 403 basically does is it outlines a program whereby the Minnesota Office of Higher Education would provide a pool of money by issuing bonds that would be lent to students at a lower rate. to refinance loan debt following graduation. There's basically four questions that we've asked of the Minnesota Higher Education to address in this Senate file. One, is there a sufficient spread between existing student loan rates and refinancing rates to make the loans attractive? Right now we're in a low interest history, and if we would refinance, is there a great enough gap that would actually make a difference? Secondly, what is the amount of bonds to be issued to make them marketable? So what would be the pool of money? Thirdly, what should the student eligibility requirements be? And then lastly, what is the appropriate cap on the amount a student may refinance? So those are some of the questions that we'd be asking the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to explore in this proposal. We've just seen a lot of data, but just some more data. Based on a 2010-2011 study, the cost of a college education in Minnesota can range from $8,570 at a two-year institution to over $54,000. And that includes tuition fees, books, room and board, but the two-year degree would not include room and board. So you have to take that into consideration. Just some of the dollar amounts at various institutions in our state. Mankato, $16,294 a year. University of Minnesota Morris, $27,770 a year. When you're looking at private colleges, Concordia College in Moorhead, $36,500. Carleton College, you're looking at a tuition, annual tuition of $54,000. Minnesota College graduates carry the third highest average debt level in the United States at just a little under $30,000 per student. The state also is the fifth largest portion of graduates carrying a student loan debt. That's 71% of our students when they graduate are carrying a loan debt. Student loan debt is surpassing $1 trillion nationally in our United States, and we have about a 10% loan default within the first 2 years of a student graduating. So I believe we need to send a message that higher education is a good investment, and as a state, we're willing to help students to guarantee their future and the future of our state. So I would ask that you would support this proposal.
Questions for Senator Klassen?
I do have a fiscal note. We're talking in the neighborhood of $70,000 to complete the study, and $20,000 would be absorbed internally by the Minnesota Office of Higher Education.
And we are in the policy division right now, but the fiscal note is here, and there is somebody available to answer questions about the fiscal note. So given that the intention of the author is to lay it over for possible inclusion, it's perfectly appropriate to ask questions about the fiscal note here. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question about the fiscal note, but I had more a question about policy, Senator. I've been wondering, I hear some stories about how students are getting in debt not only for the expenses related to their education, but also living expenses and other expenses. And I was wondering if there would be any value on incorporating a conversation into that review, because I think by offering the opportunity to refinance, we could also provide an incentive for students to kind of use the loans that they get primarily for, you know, their academic needs. You know, students, I have adolescent students, they don't really understand very well how credit cards actually work. They don't understand that they actually have to put money into them to pay for those cards eventually. So they get in debt very easily. And I wonder if we could, through, you know, some kind of providing an incentive that students who are more responsible in, you know, kind of getting their loans to pay for their needs could actually have a, you know, kind of some criteria for eligibility, because obviously we're never going to have enough to provide refinancing opportunities to every student. So somehow we're going to have to establish criteria for, you know, who do we help? And I think that providing an incentive for, educating our kids about how to handle their finances could be an important idea. I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. Senator Claussen.
Madam Chair, Senator, that definitely is one of the requirements, is the eligibility piece. And I think the Senate file, as it reads, is fairly broad. And I would hope that there would be a possibility that this group would have some input with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education to kind of review that criteria and perhaps refine it or approve it. So that definitely is one of the four components in the proposal, that there would be some eligibility requirements that would have to be established.
And Senator Torzer, it looks like Ms. Grimes would like to make a comment with regard to that.
For the record, I'm Tricia Grimes with the Office of Higher Education. Senator Torres-Ray, we appreciate your comments. In our existing self-loan program, most campuses use a mandatory quiz that students have to pass before they can get the loan. And my poor son, I tell this story all the time, but I'm going to tell it again. My son is currently getting a master's degree in the evening MBA program at the Carlson School at the University of Minnesota. And because he's my son, he thought he could get a self loan without having to pass the quiz because he had heard about the program from me over the years. But he didn't really read up on exactly what the terms and conditions of the loan are, and he flunked the quiz. So from my point of view, this is an illustration of the fact that our quiz is a meaningful tool to make sure that students know what they're getting into. And that's just an example of the kind of thing that we currently build into our existing loan program.
Ms. Grimes, I know that there is some concern that that with the current state grant program and with the tuitions set as they are, that there are some of our community colleges or technical colleges, the students are eligible for enough money that, in fact, they can use money in ways that perhaps it wasn't intended. So I think what Senator Torres-Ray is getting at also is, can we put in some parameters of an equation that makes sure that the money that we allow to be refinanced is, in fact, tuition expenses related?
Madam Chair, once a student gets money, money is fungible. It's hard to stop them from spending it on any particular thing. However, we can certainly look into whether building in some financial literacy education as a requirement for getting the refinanced loan or something like that might be something that could be considered.
Ms. Grimes, with regard to that problem on the state grant, do you have any thoughts about that?
Madam Chair, it is true that it is possible for a student to get a combined Pell Grant and state grant that might exceed their tuition, particularly at the lowest cost institutions, which is the public two-year institutions. But given the relatively low living allowances, chances are high that the amount in excess of their tuition and fees would be needed for books and things like transportation expenses and perhaps internet access in order to use their computer to do homework and that kind of thing. There's no guarantee that they couldn't spend it on beer and pizza, but it seems likely that they would have enough expenses that if they're spending it on beer and pizza now, they're spending their own money that they earned on their student job on the books later.
Good. Any other questions? With regard to the fiscal note, as long as we do have it before us, and I think somebody's actually here to – who's here to address the fiscal note?
What you said, Tricia.
Oh, you are. Sorry. Could you just discuss the fiscal note with us?
Certainly, Senator.
I understand you prepared it. I'm sorry. You do everything. My goodness.
Well, I prepared it with a lot of help from my co-worker, Marilyn Kosher, who's our self-loan program manager here. In order to figure out whether the big question with this kind of loan would be, could we make it so that we could sell revenue bonds in the marketplace? And in order to do that, you have to assure the investors that their risk is going to be covered. And so you have to figure out how the risk of non-repayment is going to be covered, and whether the interest rate we could charge would be enough, as you said, Senator, of a better interest rate compared to what the students are currently paying on their loans. And in order to do that, we would have to use the services of a financial consultant and bond counsel. And then we would also have to have discussions with the company that currently does the day-to-day servicing of our student loans, taking payments, posting payments to the right account, all that kind of stuff. And so we assume that altogether the cost for the study would be $90,000, that we would absorb $20,000 of them with existing staff because their expertise would be needed to work on the study, and that $70,000 would be spent on the consultants that we would need to help with the project. And then we made an assumption that it would not be appropriate to put all of that cost on the existing self-loan borrowers because only some of them might benefit from the refinancing study. And so we suggested that the $70,000 could be split $35,000 to the self-loan fund and $35,000 to the general fund. Does that answer your questions?
Yes, it does. Thank you. Any questions on that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Klassen.
Ms. Grimes, would we pay tax on those consultant fees?
Depends on business to business.
Senator Klassen, that is something that we are concerned about. We are trying to figure out the impact of it right now.
Yes. Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Very good. With regard to the self-loan program, one of the things that we have talked about is the fact that the federal law prohibits us from really marketing to students the value of the SELF program. Is there any current efforts with our federal delegation to fix that? I know I have conversations with those folks, so I wondered if that's something that you'd like the committee to be working on or if you're working on that.
Senator, we would definitely appreciate the help. The federal government has something called the preferred lender requirement, which went into place in early 2010, I believe, which basically says that schools have to go through a request for proposal process before they can recommend any non-federal loan to borrowers. And in general, it is a good idea if students who need to borrow the maximum in federal Stafford loan first, because those have repayment terms that most other loans cannot match. But if they want to borrow more than the federal borrowing limits, for example, a first-year student can only borrow $5,500 in federal Stafford loans. And if they want to borrow more than that, they sometimes turn to programs like our self-loan or some private loans. There are 16 states, including Minnesota, that have state loan programs. But what is happening is this process where they have to go out for an RFP to lenders and have lenders submit the information, and then they have to have on their internet more than one lender, and the lenders have to rotate in the list so that the same lender isn't always first and all that. Most schools are choosing not to do it. They consider it too much work. Their financial aid staff is already overextended, and they're just not doing it. In the absence of that, they are not allowed to recommend our self-loan to Minnesota to the students. And our self-loan currently has a variable interest rate of 3.3% mm-hmm. and a fixed interest rate option of 7.25%. Whereas the colleges are allowed to put into students' packages parent plus loans, which have a 7.9 fixed interest rate, and the parent is the borrower, not the student. And so we are working with the congressional delegation. We've recently met with Representative Klein, who's chair of the policy committee in the U.S. House, and Senator Harkin, and some of our staff went out and visited the whole Minnesota delegation just last week. To try to see if we can get the federal government to change this requirement. But it's kind of an uphill battle. To them, it seems like a small issue because they assume that their federal parent plus loan is better than the other options available to students. Hmm.
Very good. Thank you for sharing that. Do we need a motion to lay it over?
Thank you.
I hope that was not too much.
So, Senator Klassen, would you like to move to lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that we adopt this for the omnibus bill.
For possible inclusion?
Possible.
Very good. I'm with you, but very good. But we'd all have to vote on that. Very good. Thank you. So all those in favor of Senator Klassen's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Thank you very much. And thank you, staff, for helping us with this proposal. So the final piece of the agenda today is to understand how sequestration would affect us in Minnesota with regard to higher ed, and so Ms. Grimes is back.
Madam Chair, you should have a handout that says federal appropriations and their impact on Minnesota post-secondary students. I'm hoping I don't have a PowerPoint this time. So the first thing I want to talk about is the across-the-board federal cuts that are due to go into effect starting tomorrow. This is also known as sequestration. In the agreement that Congress and the President made on the fiscal cliff that was on January 1st of this year, they, for 2 months, extended the date on which these across-the-board reductions were supposed to go into effect. And initially, the cost across-the-board reductions were estimated at 8%. For domestic spending and a little more than 8% for defense spending. But there was a tax increase on the top 1% that was agreed to as part of the fiscal cliff agreement, and so that reduced the goal of coming up with more money, either through cuts or spending, a little bit, and so now they're estimating that it will be a 5.3% across-the-board reduction. But there are quite a few things that are exempted from that reduction. Many of the mandatory spending parts of the federal budget, such as Social Security, Medicare, and student loans and federal Pell Grants, are exempted from the across-the-board reductions, at least at this time. So sequestration would not affect federal Pell Grants. Why do I mention federal Pell Grants so much? Minnesota state grants are about $150 million a year at this point. Minnesota students get $513 million a year from federal Pell Grants, and they go to about 153,000 students. So the federal Pell Grant program is very important to Minnesota students. So there are several things that the U.S. Department of Education is saying would be likely to happen under sequestration. One is that there would be some slowdowns in processing student loans and in what they call servicing student loans, because the money that's sort of available to be cut includes money that they spend on contractors who do that job for them. Then another thing that would is estimated as happening is a program called Federal Supplemental Grants to Students, or FSEOG. In 2011, 33,000 Minnesota undergraduates got FSEOG grants. And it's now estimated that something like 920 fewer students would receive those awards. Those awards tend to average about $500 per student. Federal work study, again, there's an assumption that about 500 fewer students would have federal work study jobs. And some students might have fewer hours available to them on an existing work study job. Then the Office of Higher Education gets federal funds for three kinds of programs. One is the Get Ready, Gear Up program. A 5.3% reduction in that program would be about $164,000. Now, I'm not sure that's exactly how much the reduction would be. That's meant to be kind of an example of what the percentage would be. And basically, we would try to take the cuts out of supplies rather than having to cut staff that we have working in low-income schools. But we also would probably have to reduce or eliminate a relatively new thing that we've been doing with some of those federal funds, which are grants for science, technology, engineering, and math to some low-income serving schools. Another program is called College Access Challenge Grants. Again, the goal of that program is to foster activities to increase the number of low-income students prepared for college. And some of the things we spend money on in that program are making software available to extend the efforts of high school counselors, since Minnesota has a relatively low number of high school counselors per student. And competitive grants to organizations such as College Possible, that used to be Admission Possible, and so forth, that work with students to encourage and support college attendance. Another thing we have used some of that grant funding for is to get community organizations to work with students on financial literacy, so that they will be better consumers as they enter the world of college and have to decide whether to take out student loans. And then there's also something called the Improving Teacher Quality Program, which is money that is used for grants to colleges of education around the state to provide teacher professional development in core academic areas. And again, the assumption is that there would be a 5.3% reduction that would be about $45,000. So one of the things to know about sequestration is that most federal education programs are what's called forward funded, meaning federal fiscal year 13, which is the one we're in now, would affect student aid funding for the 13-14 academic year. So the cuts would probably not impact most education programs until starting July 1st.
And Ms. Grimes, if there was an agreement reached by July 1st, then would the cuts not have any effect, even though they were, quote, in effect April, May?
Senator Bonoff, it's not entirely clear how Congress would do that, but it seems likely that if they come to an agreement before July 1st, that some of these cuts would not go into effect.
So, and these assumptions of cuts, what kind of duration is being used in the assumption?
Well, I was just assuming when I made these calculations cuts for 1 year, but presumably that those cuts might be ongoing because they want to reduce the deficit on an ongoing basis.
Right.
So unless they found offsetting cuts elsewhere or programs they were willing to discontinue elsewhere, there is the possibility that they would be ongoing.
Thank you.
So that's kind of what I had planned to say about sequestration. And next I was going to talk about the March 27th deadline, which is the next sort of crisis. But before I do that, are there any questions about sequestration? Okay, so the next crisis is that on March 27th, the current continuing resolution that is keeping the federal government operating will expire. And because they only adopted the continuing resolution for the first 6 months of the fiscal year. And that that does include Pell Grant funding for the 13-14 academic year. Actually, federal Pell Grants are scheduled to go up by $95. There's an inflation adjuster in them now for the cost of living, but they haven't funded the current maximum award of $5,550, much less the one that would be an additional $95. So Congress presumably needs to do something by March 27th in order for us to know. And when it comes to spending on the federal Pell Grant program, roughly three-fourths of the spending is from discretionary spending and one-fourth is from mandatory spending right now. So the discretionary spending is what's part of the continuing resolution, and so that's why most of the funding for the Pell Grant program is still a little bit up in the air at this point. Okay, that's what I had planned to say about the continuing resolution. Are there any questions on that?
Well, that seems to put our students at more great risk. Mm-hmm.
Right, and students all over the country, but yes. Okay, then talking a little bit more about the federal Pell Grant program, Minnesota state grants are coordinated with federal Pell Grants as we calculate what we think students need through the state grant program. We cover as much of the need first with federal Pell Grants and then fill in with state grant dollars on top of that. So if there are changes in the federal Pell Grant, that can change spending in the state grant program. And policymakers in the last 2 years and in Congress have proposed a number of changes in the Pell Grant program to reduce spending. At that time, there was assumed that there was a shortfall in the Pell Grant program. The Pell Grant program doubled in its spending over the last 5 years. Now, some of that increase in spending was due to a deliberate increase, and this is the mandatory spending part of it, that was part of the federal stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009. And that was just for 5 years. And that 5 years is going to be coming to an end. And so people have been worrying about what they were going to do about funding Pell Grants both last year, this year, and the next 2-3 years. However, there's some interesting and welcome news that came out in the Congressional Budget Office's February baseline projections, which said that, as opposed to what they had previously been projecting would be a shortfall, that they expect to end federal fiscal year 2013 with a budget surplus of $9.37 billion, which is in the 15% neighborhood. The shortfall that they had been projecting for fiscal year 15, which is when federal fiscal year 15, which is when that extra $500 that was part of the stimulus bill runs out, is now reduced to a $2 billion shortfall. So it's still a problem, but it's not as big a problem. And when I say this, the base is right around $34 billion in terms of what the feds spend on the Pell Grant program each year. So it seems like this news means it's more likely that they will at least maintain the current federal Pell Grant maximum award and level of spending, but it's still unknown whether they would start letting it increase with inflation. That's all I had prepared. Center.
Thank you, Ms. Grimes. That actually is very helpful. Any questions for members? Ms. Grimes, do you think there'd ever be a conversation at the federal level about allowing parents to deduct off their gross income payments for college education? Have you ever?
Senator, it's a good question. There is currently, there are several tax benefits for higher education. There's one that was originally called the HOPE credit, which is now called the American Opportunity Credit, which they did make permanent in the agreement that they adopted on February 1st. And families can get up to $2,000 credit, I think it is. Please don't take that amount terribly seriously. I'd have to double-check it. But they can get a tax credit. And what happens is you take their tuition fees and then you subtract the gift aid and scholarships that are received. And that net, depending on how much that is, you can get a credit for a certain percentage of that. There is also a deduction. The credit, the American Opportunity Tax Credit, phases out at, I think, $130,000 or $140,000 in income for families with joint filers. And for families with incomes above that, there is a tuition deduction that some families are taking now, which is sort of like deducting your mortgage interest. It reduces your income, but it doesn't necessarily, it has a less direct impact on how much tax you pay. Okay, I hope I said that correctly.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you very much. And with that, I believe committee's adjourned. Thank you. And again, thank you, Soren.
Thank you. Good timing.